That's real. It is time for Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, traditional small animal medicine and surgery, chiropractic, laser therapy, acupuncture, and Chinese herbal medicine, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com. With us today, Dr. Carolyn Cannon, owner and chief veterinarian at the Millerton Veterinary Practice. Hello, Dr. Cannon.
Good morning, Jill and Marshall.
Good morning.
All right. Are you ready?
I'm ready. What have you got to throw at me this morning?
All right. I don't know. Shanika in New Preston. My little two-year-old Heinz, 57, loves to play and wrestle with other dogs, but sometimes she comes out of it with a slight limp in a front leg that seems to come from the shoulder. When that happens, I've been treating her with a compress, washcloth soaked in hot water, and less exercise the next day. Is there anything else I should do? Nothing has ever come up during her checkups, but obviously there's some kind of weakness there.
So it's interesting to me that people often will decide where the lameness is coming from. So I'm wondering about that. If there isn't any, because I find it very difficult to discern just by watching a dog walk.
And can I just interject? Because as I was reading that question to you, I thought, wow, this is great. There's a whole generation, because I'm 9,000 years old as Methuselah, and I still can't figure out when one of my dogs is lame. What's the, you know,
which joint? But yeah, a lot of people do have an idea, but I think it's very difficult to tell. So I usually start my exam from the toes and go up, because you can't really tell unless you have a swollen joint where the leanness is coming from, which joint it's coming from, or you find some pain there. But this can be tough because, number one, we have a young dog who doesn't have a lot of wear and tear, and number two, it's an occasional lameness, so it can be something that's difficult to localize. So when you're at the veterinarian for the annual exam or biannual exam, then it may be that there's no pain response at all. And so what I often do in this situation is have my clients go out and run their dog, do whatever it is that causes them to be lame, make an appointment with me, and then go ahead and go out and do that activity just before coming to me so that I can try to localize where the pain is. And sometimes I can't, but I'm looking for symmetry in the muscles. I'm looking for symmetry in the joints. Range of motion, whether there's pain in the joint, whether there's pain in the tendons around the joints, whether there's pain in the long bones. So all of those things, and if I can't determine at that point, then sometimes what I'll do is refer for rehab therapy. And what that means is kind of like physical therapy for dogs. There are people who are certified canine rehabilitation therapists, and they're trained in palpating and evaluating muscles and joints, and then helping to not only correct the problem if they can figure out what it is, but also to build muscle and build core strength so that the reoccurrence doesn't happen. And I think it's really smart for Shanika to think about this as a two-year-old, with her dog's a two-year-old, because these things tend to get worse with age, and you don't want to wait until you have a really severe arthritis and then say, now I know where it is,
right?
Because you can be proactive.
And you also, the other reason is anything that you can adjust now, no pun intended, you're better off with. I had a question about structural. In canines, does it ever present as one side when it's really coming from the other?
It can absolutely look like one side when it's coming from the other, and it can look like, so if you've got pain in both knees, you have a dog with a very odd gait, and sometimes it doesn't look like lameness. So, yeah, there are all kinds of things. I have the advantage of being trained in chiropractic, and so as I'm doing my exam, if I'm finding that the joints aren't moving the way they should, then I can adjust them to move the way they should. And so, with a young dog like that who comes up lame after rough play, it may just be a chiropractic situation. So, first have your regular veterinarian do an exam after heavy play, and then you know, if you can't localize anything, actually chiropractic probably would be my second choice. And then if your chiropractor is not finding anything, which would be pretty unlikely, but if you had a couple of chiropractics and nothing was happening, then your chiropractor might go ahead and recommend rehabilitation.
Would you typically see some result shortly after chiropractic?
In a young dog, you can see them right away.
Okay, that's good to know. You know, it's good to know what time frame is, what appropriate time frame is. And I think because our next question is from Todd and Katja in Dover Plains, that there may be a similar answer. Our German Shepherd mix Mabel is getting on in years. She was a rescue, but the vet estimates her age at around 10 or 11, and sometimes her joints are stiff, especially in wet weather. We have dog aspirin on hand, but how do we know when to give it to her? Is it better to err on the side of giving it to her or withholding it?
Well, it's best to try to be, again, proactive as far as pain goes, because once pain is set up, it's more difficult to get rid of. But that being said, aspirin is one of those things that commonly causes stomach ulcers in dogs. I know you can get it at Petco and you can get it over the counter, but you do have to be careful with it and give an appropriate dose. And oftentimes the doses that I see for the weight range aren't going to be necessarily enough to, they might not cause an ulcer, but they probably aren't going to do very much help either. So giving aspirin on a regular basis is not recommended. But joint supplements are recommended if these are, you know, very likely Mabel has arthritis at 10 or 11 being a German Shepherd. And so using a joint supplement is a great idea. Getting some chiropractic work is a great idea. These dogs who are maybe not taken so well care of when they're young and you've rescued them and given them lots of everything that they need, they're still going to have, oftentimes still have some of the after effects of having a poor diet, maybe not the greatest care later on in life. And so oftentimes I will find the older dogs who are very, very stiff in the spine, the joints between the vertebrae aren't moving well. And once you can reestablish some movement there, then they feel a lot better overall, and you don't have that slow, stiff, stilted gait. But it sometimes takes 3 or 4 or 5 chiropractic sessions to get them to that place. So that's an option for you. But giving aspirin, so get back to the main question, giving aspirin on a regular basis, not a good idea. There are other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs that can be given on a daily basis. So that would be a question for the veterinarian.
And I don't know, does everything turn into a vet? Would it be worth consulting the veterinarian on this anyway about what and how much of anything Mabel should get?
Yes. I mean, you can use those non-steroidals. The companies, of course, advertise and push them for a daily use, but I use them as needed basis, absolutely. So, you know, if you've got a dog who otherwise is in great shape and just has overdone it, just as we might on a weekend, you know, with a 7-hour hike, then absolutely it's fine to use it in that situation.
No, I'm just going to say, if you know you've been on a 7-hour hike, I mean, again, in consultation with your veterinarian, is it better to
pre-medicate?
I don't want to say pre-medicate before the hike. I just mean, do you wait until the dog looks like, oh my God, I've just been on a 7-hour hike, or do you before bed give?
Yeah, if it's a repeated problem, then probably a good idea to give it before bed. Or you can use arnica, which is a homeopathic remedy. You know, read on that a little bit and use some arnica.
And I'm going to spell that for people, because every time I say, why don't you use some arnica, they look at me as though, once again, I've got 5 heads. Arnica, A-R-N-I-C-A. It's pretty decent.
Right. Yeah, it's not the be-all and end-all, but on some types of pain, it works quite well and is absolutely worth a try and not going to be really unlikely to have any side effects.
Yeah, that is the one great thing to me. Long before I've had an ancillary interest in homeopathics and natural, what is referred to as complementary. And very rarely a downside to a homeopathic.
Exactly.
So, it might not do anything, but it is not going to hurt. And
right.
Going back to first do no harm, that just really suits my type of logic.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Jason and Rhinebeck. Lottie, my girlfriend's cat, is a total freak for heat. She always seems to want to get warmer, even on hot days. My girlfriend says she's been like this since she was a kitten. Now that the weather is turning, she presses up against the radiator all day. Is there a reason for this or just preference?
So it's possible that Lottie is very thin cat. You know, thin people and thin cats have a hard time generating heat. It sounds like she's done this her whole life, so it sounds like part of her metabolism. She may have just a very low metabolism and isn't producing a lot of heat from the calories that she eats. It's possible that she's anemic, but I'm assuming that she's had some veterinary care and that she doesn't have anemia, which is a low red blood cell count. So if that is all, if she has no health concerns, then it isn't a problem. Some cats just really love to soak in the heat. And it is part of it's certainly part of something I ask as I do a Chinese herbal or acupuncture evaluation, because it definitely is part of the overall constitution. But it's not necessarily a bad thing and doesn't necessarily mean bad things. She's probably very happy to be an indoor cat. I don't know if she'd do very well outdoors.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of thing to it's always the sort of thing to think about, especially around the holidays when there are very not for cats per se, except that what's the difference in lifespan? Typically, there's a rule of thumb between indoor and outdoor cats.
Well, there's so many things that can happen, right, with an outdoor cat.
Yeah.
So indoor cats do tend to live into their late teens. It's unusual for an outdoor cat to live past 10 or 11 if they're just outdoors. But indoors and outdoors, they're just safer when they're indoors. They're not exposed to as much. But on the other hand, they don't get as much exercise. So depending on the size of the house and the numbers of pets, it's more difficult to exercise that indoor cat. And so sometimes they have diseases associated with obesity.
Right. And, again, as we get further and further along the wellness trail, it's interesting. Are there places that people can go to find out, hey, this is the best way to care for a creature? It's coming on the holidays, and people, tend to say, okay, we're going to get that puppy for the holidays, or we're going to get that cat.
Oh, yeah. I just recommend not doing it.
Yeah. And
there's no circumstances that I can think of that it's appropriate to bring in a kitten or a puppy at Christmas time.
You mean despite the commercials?
It's too chaotic. You don't have the time to pay attention, and you need to. This needs to be your project, a new puppy, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience. And, if you want a dog who's going to be with you for years and is a great dog, you need to work at it. And it's a very difficult thing to do around the holidays, especially when you have children who are excited and lots of new things all over the place for puppies to get into. So, I say that. I don't think people like it very well, but I can't see any particular circumstance in where it would be appropriate, and I wouldn't do it for myself, even though I'm a grown-up and don't have small children at home.
Yeah, no, and so the best recommendation that I have ever heard, and I will pass this along, you don't have to endorse it or not, but is if you are going to get that pet, and that's been the promise and you've made it, then you get a couple of accoutrements. You get, you get a leash and a little bed, or something. You get something. Not the body itself,
mm-hmm.
But you get something to wrap up, and you make it a gift, and everybody can be as excited.
Yes.
Without the, This is another thing. Too much the advertising. It's wonderful because none of the pets that you see on a commercial for whether it's dog food or I don't know, whatever, seem to come with any problems like chewing on things or, you know, having stomach problems first thing in the
eating the tinsel and breaking the I can't tell you how many dogs eat Christmas ornaments, and sometimes they'll actually chew on light bulbs, and that's a really serious problem. So to have all that going on and to have to try to watch your puppy,
it's a level of chaos, but it's equally traumatic when you are not, when you're in accident, when you're in the emergency room.
Mm-hmm.
It just really messes up the holidays. And
it does, and it's completely avoidable. So you're right. If you're going to get a puppy around Christmas, you're going to wait at least a couple of weeks after Christmas to pick up that pup and then focus on the puppy.
Yeah, and I just say that I was thinking about that the other night, and especially that there are these studies that are just absolutely fascinating. The people who have pets are just happier in their lives than people who don't.
They are. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and
why it's been such a lasting thing in our evolution.
that stuck around. This is the time where I know that a lot of people just go, okay, it's time. And just practically speaking, it's great, great, great decision. But again, hold off on the body till things settle down and there's a more regular routine, because the main thing you're going to want to establish with whoever, whether or not you're rescuing or whatever, the main thing you're going to want to establish is that routine.
Right.
And this is not a time of year that's notorious for that. All right, Gail in Manhattan. I know we're not in salt season yet, but it's coming up, so we live in the city. When the sidewalks have got ice melt all over them, we wipe off the dog's paws when we come in from a walk with them. But obviously some of the ice melt stuff is getting all over the floors. Are we supposed to be mopping all the time? Can the dogs get it in their mouths from picking it up off the floors onto their paws and then licking it off? My husband thinks I'm paranoid about this, but some of that stuff is super toxic. What do you say?
I say that it all is toxic. The chemicals that are used to melt ice are toxic in general. Things like magnesium chloride and sodium chloride, all the salts, calcium carbonate, calcium magnesium acetate, those types of things that melt salt. You know, if your dog ingests them in large quantities, can actually be lethal. But in moderate to smaller quantities are definitely irritants to the gastrointestinal tract. So a small amount from licking paws, you know, if you're licking paws three times a day because you've been outside and not no one's paying attention to the salt, excuse me, then, you know, minimally you can end up with some nausea and vomiting, hypersalivation, sometimes diarrhea. If there's enough salt ingestion, you can have tremor. Your dog can have tremors, also, which isn't very comfortable. The salt can irritate their paws and the skin between the paws, kind of a burning sensation. The pads can crack over time, so that exposure to the salts is not a great idea, which makes it, high maintenance in the winter. If you have a small dog, or even if you've got a large dog, boots can help quite a bit as far as this goes, and just remove those boots whenever it's appropriate. If no one else in your, if everyone's tracking in the stuff, it's going to even be in the hallways, I think. So right before you get into the apartment or as you're going in, removing the boots is really helpful. If you don't use boots, then you've got to clean those feet, including between the pads, every time you go outside. So you're coming back. You can dip. That would be a great idea, but keeping that water by the door can be make a big mess, especially if you've got more than one dog. You can just use a damp cloth. So before you go out, use a clean, damp cloth, hang it on the inside doorknob, and as you come in, then just wipe off as much as you possibly can. Having a a mat by the door that's going to then absorb that water as they walk across it and then into the house is probably a good idea. So a little bit of salt getting in the house, you'll see it on the floor because it dries and it'll be white.
Oh, yeah, it looks like an Arthur Murray dance studio sort of
thing. So you can sweep it up later as long as your dogs aren't trying to lick it. So it's a little bit of an individual thing. Some dogs are not fastidious and they're not going to bother to lick their paws, but they will lick when their skin is irritated.
Right.
So if you're getting off enough of the salts, then there probably won't be any skin irritation. And they do. The dogs get used to this. It becomes a routine and they're okay with it, most dogs.
Okay, so basically, looks like Gail is Gail's question is if they get it up off the. She seems to be fine on the wiping the paws.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she could wipe a little more.
I don't think you have to be meticulous about getting every molecule.
Right.
But getting the majority off is a great idea.
Right.
If your dog is crazy about the salt and trying to lick their paws and lick your other dog's paws and lick the floor, and then you have to be more meticulous. Some dogs can tolerate the salt and it doesn't bother their stomachs. And if you're talking about a little bit of licking of a little bit of salt a couple of times a day, probably is not going to bother each individual. So I think that she's right to be paranoid about it, but so calling it, you know, really toxic, I wouldn't say it is really, really toxic as some other drugs are, but I would be very careful about cleaning off salt.
Cleaning it off the body. In the floor, I guess where I'm getting hung up in this particular question is she cleans up the dogs, but a teeny bit gets on the floor. And should she be worried about the stuff on the floor?
Only if your dog's trying to lick the floor.
Right, okay.
Or, you know, walking in it. So I'm envisioning a New York apartment where you have kind of that hallway as you come in,
right,
usually.
Like the foyer, right.
The foyer. So you're going to have something there to soak up the sloppy water that you're putting on their feet. And you know, I don't live in New York, but here I get that snow off their feet. We have towels all over our entryway.
Oh, yeah.
And we get the snow off their feet, and it does make a mess in the house, and then we just live with it because we have dogs. But,
right.
You know, so you've got that damp towel, and then you can have a dry towel, too, and you're going to get 95% of the salt off if you're doing that before they walk into the rest of the house.
Right, and that's probably where she's fine, and that's how it works.
Mm-hmm. And then you want to be careful about allowing them to drink from puddles of melted snow.
Oh, God, yes. Right. Something else to worry about.
Yeah, and even the pet-friendly ice melts can be a problem if enough is ingested. So they're all toxic.
Well, that's clear. Thank you very much, Dr. Cannon.
You're welcome. On that happy note, have a good day.
And you. This has been Pet Files Ask the Vet, underwritten by the Millerton Veterinary Practice, 518-789-3440, millertonvet.com.